It's going to take a lot of collaboration to get humans to Mars, but we're up for the challenge. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. A few weeks ago, Matt Kaplan, the creator of this show and now Senior Communications Advisor at the Planetary Society, took an adventure to the Humans to Mars Summit. It's hosted by our friends at Explore Mars. We'll share his conversation with three NASA Associate Administrators, Nicola Fox, James Free, and James Reuter, about the international, commercial, and robotic collaboration that it's going to take to get the first humans to Mars. Then Bruce Betts and I will share what's up in the night sky and a chance to win a grab bag of prizes in one of our last space trivia contests. And now for some space news. The James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, has found signs of an essential carbon molecule in a planet-forming disk. Methanium, also known as methyl cation, is a carbon compound thought to play an important role in organic chemistry by building more complex carbon molecules, which are the foundation of life as we know it. JWST once again proved its astonishing sensitivity when it detected methanium in a protoplanetary disk in the Orion Nebula. And researchers have found an object that blurs the lines between planet and star. The object is a brown dwarf, a class of celestial objects that typically is hotter than a planet, but cooler than the coolest red dwarf stars. This particular brown dwarf has temperatures hotter than those of the sun, although it's just on one side. This is because that side of the brown dwarf faces a nearby white dwarf star. This new discovery is shedding light on classes of objects that defy our usual categorization. Meanwhile in Europe, ESA is taking big steps to reduce orbital debris. The European Space Agency and three European satellite manufacturers recently announced plans to address the issue of potentially dangerous debris in Earth orbit. They're developing a zero debris charter that would hold signatories responsible for deorbiting their satellites at the end of their operating lifetimes. And lastly, the Mars sample return mission is facing challenges. The NASA program, which aims to collect and return to Earth the samples of Martian regolith that the Perseverance rover has been selecting and caching, is undergoing a second independent review amid growing cost estimates and daunting technical and managerial challenges. Planetary Society Chief of Space Policy Casey Dreyer unpacks this issue and explains how it could affect other planetary science missions in one of our newest articles. You can read Casey's article and learn more about any of these stories in the June 30th edition of our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. Read it or subscribe to have it sent to your inbox for free every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. And now for our main topic of the day. How do we get humans to the red planet? Explore Mars' annual conference, the Humans to Mars Summit, was held on May 16th through 18th at the National Academy of Sciences building in Washington, D.C., USA. The conference brought together leaders from NASA, commercial and industrial space companies, international leaders, and STEM professionals to think about the next steps that it's going to take to get humans to the red planet. And if possible, accomplish this mind-blowing feat by the mid-2030s. It's going to take a lot of teamwork to get the first humans to Mars, but can you imagine what it would mean for humanity? Our friend Matt Kaplan, who created this show and is the former host of Planetary Radio, is now our senior communications advisor at the Planetary Society, and he hosted a panel at the conference with three NASA associate administrators. Nicola Fox from the Science Mission Directorate, James Free from the Exploration Systems Development Mission Directorate, and James Reuter from the Space Technology Mission Directorate. During the conversation, you'll hear them refer to NASA's CLPS, or CLPS, program. That stands for the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program. With the CLPS initiative, NASA has been competitively funding commercial companies to build spacecraft that autonomously land on the moon, taking NASA science and technology payloads along with them.
I assume that is for the very distinguished panel that I'm honored to bring out today. To start, to my immediate left, Nikki Fox, of the Science Mission Directorate, then Jim Free, who is the ESDMD, Exploration Systems Development Mission Directorate, and Jim Reuter, who there's something special that has to be said here, Space Technology Mission Directorate, of course. But what was it? 2 weeks ago, I think I got the release from NASA that you are ready to retire after over 40 years with the agency, rising to associate administrator. So congratulations and thank you, Jim. Please.
I do want to say thank you. I really appreciate the sentiment. But what I would say is, I think you said I was ready, announced I was ready to retire. A more accurate way to say is probably that I have decided to retire. We'll determine whether I'm ready.
Okay. Coming soon. And we may come back to that because I may want to hear about some highlights from you. It's not, strictly speaking, the title or fit the theme of this particular session, but I have to ask because it's what we're talking about overall. And we're following that panel of experts on can we get humans to Mars or at least around Mars by 2033? Can we put footprints on Mars by 2040? I'll throw it out to all of you. Nikki?
Oh, I think we're certainly very supportive of doing it. We're doing all the pre-work that we can to do it, but I think that would be a bit ambitious, Jim. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you've heard our deputy administrator talk about 2039 mission. And I think when we back that up and connect it with what we're trying to do on the moon, that is going to be tough. Really, we have to start launching things in probably 2032, 2035. To head out to the moon, to pre-position things for the crew with the current architecture that we would have in place. We also need some time to learn on the moon in that reduced gravity environment of how our systems work, including our human systems. So it absolutely is aggressive to do that, but that's the timeline that I worry about and getting stuff done in time to meet those launch dates.
And I'd say that is an audacious goal. For us to meet. And as Jim said, and what 2039 implies is that you really start the transit there, the logistics train, in the early 2030s. So the audaciousness of the 2033 discussion you just had is about when you'd have to start accomplishing that. And for me, you know, we run technology, so a big part of this is, well, do we have the technologies ready for that? And, well, 2039, well, okay, that's 17 years or 16 years from now. It may sound like a lot, but it's a very short time in terms of many of the technologies that we need to develop or really need to be going strongly. So
you've already brought up something that I wanted to mention, and I kind of puzzle over why we still have some people asking why the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. Why don't we just go straight to Mars? I mean, I would think by now, anybody who's really looked at this would know, let's get our feet wet or dusty on the moon before we tackle the red planet. I think I'm right about that, yeah?
I mean, I think that's where I was going with we need some time to understand, right? If I take the ISS analogy, we use the ISS to we tested systems for the ISS on the ground, and then we launched them, and I think the gentleman to my left here had something to do with it, and we learned that they stopped when they got in microgravity for a variety of reasons, the fluid behavior, whatever it might be. We learned that lesson on ISS of the analog. So we don't want to get to go right to Mars and then have everything gunk up, to use a technical term, and not having tested it on the moon. But the connectivity for the moon to Mars is important of the systems, but don't lose sight of what there is to learn scientifically on the moon. So we're going to go and test our human systems, but our priority is to do the science that we can do on the moon that's outlined by Nikki and by the Moon to Mars objectives as well. So they're connected system-wise, but I think don't overlook the science as well.
Jim Free, I'm going to stick with you, but please, everybody, jump in as you wish. It's only been, what, 6-7 weeks since I got the press release about the creation of the Moon to Mars Program Office, which seems like it very much fits the theme of this session, the collaboration that is going to be absolutely necessary among your directorates and others if we're going to have success in all of this. Can you tell us a little bit about that office and how it represents that collaboration?
Sure. So we actually have kind of three offices that report to the associate administrator, currently me. One is our strategy and architecture office, which is really tasked with planning the long-term missions. So you think Artemis 6 and out, they're really focused on that architecture, connecting Moon to Mars. And then the Moon to Mars program office is really down and in, think near-term missions, Artemis 5 through Artemis 2. But they both have interfaces to these two mission directorates, both of those offices I talked about. So we want to plan that strategy and architecture with technology infusion in mind, with science in mind. And then the Moon to Mars program office, those near-term missions, how are we running the technology that's on there and how are we doing the science? But the scope of that office, Moon to Mars, I think is important because the Mars element of that office is pulling the technologies. It's providing requirements to the lunar missions, to the lunar systems, to develop the hardware that we need and keep that connectivity so we're not developing a life support system that has no connectivity to what we want to use on the surface of Mars or on the way to Mars. So the scope of that office is great for that reason, but it's also very much focused on the near-term missions to get it done.
And for us, when Jim formed the Moon to Mars Program Office, Strategy Analysis Office, it really aligned us well. And it gives us a path towards having understanding the key technology gaps we have to satisfy and which ones are those highest priority, because we can't afford to fund everything. So we've got to be really judicious about what we do and do as much with partnerships as we can.
And for the science, I mean, I think it gives us a really easy interface into the other mission directorate. And, you know, we obviously, we're scientists. We want to do everything everywhere all of the time. And, you know, these missions, it's a place to really get the requirements ironed out and who's responsible for them and what's actually possible on the various missions. Obviously, we're starting kind of early. We're sending our CLIPS landers to the moon, commercial partners, and, you know, they'll be starting to launch later this year. We're really excited about that. We're working on that, but we're also looking at what we can do with Artemis 2. Obviously, we had science on Artemis 1. We had the biological and physical science inside the Orion capsule itself. So what are we going to do with Artemis 2? And then, you know, for me, it's what's the really exquisite science that we're going to do with astronauts who can actually make decisions right there, kind of focusing our efforts and giving us a partner to really kind of iron these things out with.
We got a lot of great science out of Apollo, still getting great science out of Apollo.
Yes.
But, you know, there was always that push and pull between we got to get the astronauts there and back safely. And that takes me right to the next question I was hoping to ask you to talk to you about. And that's the kinds of things that the most critical steps in terms of preparing to do the science, but also the technologies, the technology demonstrations that the moon is going to enable for us. And Gateway is going to enable for us that we really have to see. I know we're partway there, right? There's been good progress, but we still have a ways to go before we can get humans to Mars and back safely.
I mean, I would say I talked about the systems on the surface that we can test and use on Mars. Gateway's incredibly important. We can run Mars analog missions from Gateway. So we can send the crew there, have them spend 6 months on Gateway in some of our later expeditions out there, like they're flying to Mars for 6 months, and get deconditioned as you do in microgravity, then send them down to the lunar surface for 30 days, have them operate, test themselves out, and then come back to Gateway and stay for 6 months, and then come back to Earth. So we can simulate a Mars mission from microgravity to partial gravity back to microgravity, which will help inform how the human responds, but we'll be doing science all the way through that. And we'll need the technologies that Jim and his team are developing to make that happen. Some of the advanced ECLIS from radiation protection as an example of things that really drive our systems. So I think the connection is clearly there for me.
Jim, I mean, that's a great example, radiation. You'd be outside the Van Allen belts.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a lot like a trip to Mars.
Yeah, absolutely is. And there's a lot we'll learn from Mars. Some of the technologies that we have working on is, you know, the gateway, the propulsion elements of the gateway, the electric thrusters are an advanced size design that we actually have just delivered the qualification unit as part of our development for activity for it. The solar arrays that will power the gateway is a long time development that we had in technology that has on the rollout solar arrays that are now also the replacement arrays for station used in missions as well as gateway. When you look at the surface, there's so many things that we're going to be doing there and operating, establishing an infrastructure is one of the key elements that you can do in terms of establishing a base here, a foothold on Moon, and then that activity is understanding how we do that from Mars. Reliable power source, the life support, and advanced habitation systems, and all these sort of things we can learn a lot from being on the Moon first.
Whole new technologies that are in development, not only across directorates, but across NASA centers. Commercial side has been a pretty notable success in recent years. Can you talk a little bit more about how these relationships have evolved and are also going to help us get out to the red planet?
For us, obviously, we're building off the success of commercial cargo and commercial crew and those models that have been put in place. We're buying services for our landers. So our first two lander awards were to SpaceX for the first lander for Artemis 3, and then their more sustainable lander. And we have a competition that will make the announcement here very
tomorrow.
Soon.
You're among friends. Care to tip us off?
No, it's out there now. So yeah, tomorrow. For our other lander provider, which is a service, we're buying our spacesuits as a service as well, which has started off good for us. And then we're looking at things like our lunar terrain vehicle, our unpressurized rover to buy as a service. Also, we had our draft RFP about that. So it's going well. I mean, there's challenges. We all see that, we need Starship to launch and be successful for our first lander. It's a great process. It's a good contract structure in terms of cost savings, but we still need to hit schedule. And that's what's driving me right now is hitting schedule. And all of and buying services, no matter what we're getting. But those are the three I'd highlight as our prime examples.
Nikki, you started to address this with commercial participation in science activities. Expand on that.
Yeah, so we have a couple. So one is obviously the CLPS, the commercial lunar payload that we're sending to the moon. I've actually been touring and visiting some of our providers, the industry partners who are actually providing the landers. It's really cool to actually see the lander and see the science on the side of it. But, really looking forward to getting those up to schedule to go this year. Many more to schedule to go after that. Going to very challenging areas. I mean, things like landing at the South Pole, landing in total shadow. And having to survive the night. There's some pretty exciting things. One that will be these are sort of the tech demos that Jim might talk more about, but one that's actually going to hop. So it'll land and then it'll hop into the shadow. And then, the plan is anyway, it'll hop back out again. They're just really, really cool things that we're doing. And we're taking advantage of maturing these commercial capabilities, but putting science on them wherever we go. Also, as we transition from the ISS to commercial LEO destinations, starting to plan what can we do with these sort of new facilities. And I mentioned Cirrus as one example of actually being able to do science sort of on the spot, as opposed to having to take years. But even looking at what we can do with biological and physical sciences, can we put some of those experiments on CubeSats and launch them, as Jim said, launch them with Artemis or launch them with one of our other commercial providers, instead of always waiting for an opportunity on ISS. Can we take advantage of some of these other commercial partnerships just to get more science into space? That's my goal.
Thank you, all three of you. Keep it up and onward to the moon and Mars. And please, one more round of applause for our three associate administrators.
I've yet to go to the Humans to Mars Summit myself, but it's definitely on my bucket list. And whether or not we can send humans to Mars by the 2030s, the fact that it's within reach is beautiful. There were a lot of wonderful panels and conversations at the Humans to Mars Summit this year, and events from all 3 days of the conference are available to watch online for free. You can hear the extended version of this conversation with Matt Kaplan and NASA Associate Administrators Nicola Fox, James Free, and James Reuter in the podcast and online version of this show at planetary.org/radio or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. We'll be right back for What's Up after this short break.
Ready to level up your space game? Hi, I'm Amber, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society, and we are launching our brand new digital member community. This is a place that's built exclusively for Planetary Society members. Here you can connect with fellow members from around the world, join live events you won't get anywhere else, and delve deeper into the wonders of our cosmos and the missions that explore them. It's all about putting the Society in the Planetary Society. I'll see you on the digital frontier.
Hello, I'm George Takei, and as you know, I'm very proud of my association with Star Trek. Star Trek was a show that looked to the future with optimism, boldly going where no one had gone before. I want you to know about a very special organization called the Planetary Society. They are working to make the future that Star Trek represents a reality. Boldly go to build our future.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. And now it's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Sarah.
How's it going?
Hunky dory, spiffy keen swell.
Or and should you? I say, what's up?
Planets, stars, stuff. But all right, we'll just get right into it. Venus, still over there, hanging out in the west after sunset. Looking super, super bright. If you look above Venus, you'll see the much dimmer Mars. And Mars will be hanging out with a similarly bright, slightly brighter star, Regulus, the brightest star in Leo. I'll be particularly close to it on the night of July 10th. So that's kind of fun. And then the moon in the pre-dawn east on July 11th, the moon will be next to bright Jupiter. So Jupiter's in the pre-dawn east, looking very bright. Saturn's running away off into the west, so you can see it high in the sky by dawn. It's actually rising in the middle of the night. You might be able to catch maybe Mercury, but there's a lot of other good stuff. On the night of July 20th, we've got the moon near Mars. So Mars looking dimish. They're off in the west all the time, but the crescent moon joins Mars on July 20th. And that's what's up.
I usually keep listener comments for later, but we actually had someone write in this week to say thank you to you, Bruce. Laura Dodd from Eureka, California wrote in to say that because of your What's Up segment and what wasn't going on in the sky, that she was able to keep her friends looking for Mars to appear in the dusk sky on the solstice, specifically because of What's Up, and that it made a really pretty triangle with Venus and the moon.
Oh, cool. Excellent, excellent. Wonderful. Always good to hear stuff like that. And speaking of good stuff, we'll go on to this week in space history. 1979, Voyager 2 flew past Jupiter, and we grabbed a bunch more cool imagery and data about the big planet and its big old moons and the little ones. And then 20 years ago, the Mars rover Opportunity launched, headed off to do its thing at Mars and find all sorts of great stuff.
I know it was 20 years ago, but it doesn't feel like 20 years ago.
Yes. I know this feeling.
Yeah.
I know it well. On to random space fact.
Do you need a cough drop?
Yeah, probably. No, I'm good. Good. Just wanted to share that. Lunar material returned by the Apollo astronauts. Probably no 382 kilograms or 842 pounds of lunar material brought back in 2,200 individual specimens, which have been processed into more than 110,000 individually cataloged samples, hanging out and distributed by the curators at Johnson Space Center.
That's a lot of samples.
Let us move on to the trivia contest, where I asked you, what is the closest nebula to Earth? How'd we do, and did people agree?
People agreed on this one, although they had all kinds of fun names for it. One person, Julie Kelly from Copernicus Cove, Texas, called it the Creepy Eyeball Nebula.
Ah, yes, its original name.
Kind of looks like the Eye of Sauron or something, but it's the Helix Nebula.
Indeed.
Which
you know, when we say it's the closest one to Earth, I mean, close is relative, but in space, you know, we're talking about an object that's about 700 light years away. So it's actually quite distant, but you know, close when you think about
it. Yeah, it's all relative, but relative to us, it's really far away.
Really far away.
Relative to the size of the galaxy, pretty darn close. Size of the universe, practically touching it.
It's funny too, because it's hard for me to remember because I was so young, but I'm pretty sure the Helix Nebula was the first thing I ever looked at through a telescope. Because I remember running back to my mom and calling it the Space Cheerio. Considering that it's probably closer than like the Ring Nebula or something, it's probably the thing I saw. But our winner this week is Darcio Cordeira from Taubaté, Brazil. I haven't gotten to give anything to someone in Brazil yet, so I love this. Your prize, Darcio, is a collection of Orly NASA JWST nail polishes and nail stickers. So if you don't personally use nail polish, highly recommend giving these as a gift to someone. I'm giving them to a bunch of my friends because who doesn't love putting the Carina Nebula on everything?
Huh. Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
And I'm sure people are wondering this in their brains, because last episode we announced that we were going to be moving the Space Trivia Contest from What's Up into our member community. And since then, I've gotten some questions from people asking how they can send in their questions and comments so we can continue to share them on the show. And don't worry, everyone, we've got you. So you can send us any of your cool stories or comments or questions for Bruce. If you've got cool space questions, you can email them to us at radio@planetary.org. And to make it easier, on our website for each Planetary Radio page, where we usually have the section that links to our contest page, we're going to be linking to this email. So it will still be just as easy for you to send us all your comments, because I love reading them. I love all the poetry and the messages that people send us. It's like part of the highlight of my week, getting to read people's messages.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, this was so cool because months ago, I want to say it was May, we had a space trivia contest winner named Aquiel Godot. And at the time, we had a conversation about whether or not the name Aquiel came from that Star Trek The Next Generation episode called Aquiel. And she actually wrote in this week to answer the question. The answer is yes. She was named for that episode of Star Trek. I wish my name had such a cool origin. Like, what about you? Are you secretly named for Bruce Wayne or something?
There was thought of renaming me the Gorn. It's a little original series obscurity.
So what's our next trivia contest question, Bruce? We only have two questions left.
Oh, which a good one. Who is the oldest person to have flown in space? Suborbital is okay. Half past the Van Karman line at 100 kilometers. And to be really specific, who is at the oldest age when they flew in space? Not necessarily who's oldest now. Anyway, who's the oldest person to have flown in space? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
And you have until Wednesday, July 12th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us your answer. And since we're down to the last two space trivia contest questions on the show before we move it into the community, I'm giving away some giant prizes. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but I'm throwing in stickers and patches and posters and all kinds of cool stuff that I have on my desk just waiting to be prizes. But the thing that everyone's going to be happiest about, I think, is that we tracked down a few extra rubber asteroids. So our next two winners will receive some of the last squishy stress ball asteroids we have.
Awesome. Excellent for demonstrating asteroid impact.
It makes me feel a little better because I have one on my desk that I'm unwilling to give away. And for a moment there, I was considering giving it away as one of the last trivia contest prizes, you know, but now I get to keep it.
Now you don't have to.
Yep.
That's nice. All right, everybody, go out there, look on the night sky, and think about dental floss. Thank you and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio. But we'll be back next week with even more space science and exploration. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our dedicated members. Mark Hilverda and Ray Paletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.